You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
They were the wealthiest and arguably the most influential men of their day. Cornelius Vanderbilt, Andrew Carnegie, and Andrew Mellon helped build the American economy in countless ways, but became known as the robber barons along the way. Joining me now are three award-winning biographers, T.J. Stiles, author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, published by Knopf, David Nassau, author of Andrew Carnegie, published by Penguin Books, and by Sir David Cannadine, author of Mellon, An American Life from Vintage Books. I'm very pleased to welcome all three of you back to our show. Hi.
Hello.
Good to be here.
It's very nice to be back.
And I'd like to go around this panel with my first question. Do you think that there's one quality or personality trait that helped make each of these men successful in their respective areas and industries? And I'm going to begin with David Nassau because he's in the studio with me.
Well, I think there's an extraordinary self-confidence in each of these guys. There is a sense that they've got it right, that they can see the past, but more importantly, they live in the present and they can see into the future. They know what's coming. And that self-confidence breeds an adventurism and an aggressive adventurism.
But didn't they almost see themselves as infallible?
I think they began to see themselves as infallible because everything they did turned out right. Carnegie had a couple of failures early in life, but from the time he was 25 on, it was just success piled on success piled on success.
T.J. Stiles?
I can only speak for Cornelius Vanderbilt, but I think one of the things that really drove him was an intense pride. For example, when he moved into railroads after having concentrated in shipping for all of his life, he took on a railroad that everybody considered worthless. He wanted to show that he could make it into a profitable line. And I think another thing is that he was also someone who could take momentary opportunities that appeared in the course of business competition and turn it into long-term transitions in his career, that he could find the long-term developments that appeared in a momentary opportunity in the midst of business combat.
David Cannadine, Mellon came along a little after the others, but didn't their lives overlap?
Yes, Mellon's a considerable generation later. Cornelius Vanderbilt, born 1794, Andrew Carnegie, born 1835, Andrew Mellon, born 1855. So a later figure, and interestingly, therefore, and unlike Vanderbilt and Carnegie, not just a child of the world of heavy industry, of steel and steamboats and coal, but also a child of the world of chemicals and electronics and oil. Mellon's fortune unusual in the sense that it straddles a whole variety of different businesses. But of course, one has to remember that unlike Vanderbilt and Carnegie, in addition, Mellon was a banker first and foremost, not a businessman or an industrialist, and saw his job as enabling other people to do well in other businesses. And so that's, in a sense, his sense of himself is that he's a venture capitalist, putting up money for bright young men to make fortunes for themselves and in the process to make a fortune for him as well. Hence, that produces Gulf Oil, Coppers, Carborundum, Alcoa, an astonishing portfolio of companies across a range of industries. Mellon's judgment, I think, of men and of business and of new ideas and their potential to be applied to the process, productive processes and making money, was exceptionally good. So I would certainly want to say that Mellon would score high in terms of that. But I think what we have to be careful of course, in overstressing the importance of these figures, is that it was partly the circumstances, the times in which they were operating. And as one of their contemporaries, Frick, once said, the demands of modern life called for such works as ours. If we had not met the demands, others would have done so. And it's important to notice, I think, therefore, that although Vanderbilt and Carnegie and Mellon were people of undoubted gifts, if they hadn't come along, other people probably would have done.
But Mellon was one of the first venture capitalists, wasn't he?
I think he was, yes. I mean, that's the phrase we would use to describe him now. It wasn't, of course, a phrase that was current at the time. But he saw himself as a facilitator and as an enabler, that he put up money for other people to make more money from and to produce new goods. And indeed, Mellon's notion of himself as a facilitator and an enabler is not merely the key to his astonishing success as a banker and as a facilitator of other businesses. It's also the key to his later activities as a philanthropist, where he sees himself as doing very much the same thing.
But T.J. Sells, wasn't the term robber baron first introduced into the American vernacular to describe Cornelius Vanderbilt?
To the best of my knowledge, that's correct.
And where does the phrase come from?
Well, that's one of the interesting things, is as we talk about these three guys, since Cornelius Vanderbilt was, as just mentioned, the earliest of them, his life traces the transition of the United States from sort of almost a post-colonial trading society into an industrial society. And so the term robber baron came about at a time when that transition was underway, and actually reflected an earlier idea of politics and the economy. In 1859, the editor of the New York Times, who was an old Whig, Henry J. Raymond, attacked Vanderbilt as a robber baron for, quote, carrying out competition for competition's sake, competition which crowds out legitimate enterprises. And in an America before there were large enterprises, before big business really came into being, the idea of competition was very much a radical idea, and the idea of so-called legitimate enterprises which serve a public good was a more conservative Whig ideal. And so, perversely, Vanderbilt was being criticized for being, in essence, too radical of a figure in the American economy. Of course, you know, as he grew in power and as businesses grew in scale, the term robber baron then became a term for a monopolist who crowds out competitors. And so it's interesting to see how the term came about in an earlier political framework that reflects an earlier economy in which there basically were no large enterprises as we now know them.
David Nassau, was Carnegie also called a robber baron?
Yeah, Carnegie was called a robber baron. The term was generalized to mean
it started
any
in Germany,
rich guy.
Didn't it?
I think it's a feudal term. Yeah, it's about the guy who, instead of letting people pass by his road, the baron puts up a toll gate and charges them to come through, robs visitors by closing down the highways. Carnegie, you know, Carnegie never paid attention to any of this. He was rather remarkable. He convinced himself that he was doing the right thing. Competition was good, and he was going to destroy everybody else, but the result was going to be lower prices, and that was good for the world. Who could complain if he brought down the price of steel rails, if he brought down the price of steel beams, if skyscrapers and railroads could be built cheaper? The whole world would benefit. Therefore, he was doing what was good not only for himself, but for the larger community.
Although maybe not for the people who are working for him.
The people who were working for him were certainly not benefiting. But he rationalized that as well. I mean, in effect, his workers were sacrificed for the greater good. The cheaper he could get them to work, the less he could pay them, the longer hours, the cheaper the steel, and the greater the benefit to the larger community.
Well, we hear the same kind of argument today when people justify going to third world countries to get products made at for the lowest possible cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The end for all these guys justifies the means. If people have to be sacrificed along the way, including people in your home community, so be it.
So is this the time when the word competitive stopped being a dirty word?
Well, I just wanted to add in one thing based on that, to elaborate on this, which is that, you know, in the life of these individuals, we see the kind of conundrums that come from a corporate economy. You know, Professor Nassau is exactly correct that each of these guys helped to create a more productive economy in which costs were dramatically lowered. The efficiency and the lower costs of transportation that Vanderbilt helped pioneer or the lower steel costs that Carnegie introduced had a tremendous beneficial effect, just as, for example, Walmart does today. And at the same time, it comes at a cost. That, you know, they were looking to reduce costs, and so labor was an operating cost. It was an expense that they had to reduce. And so, you know, for the larger society, as they saw it was benefiting from their actions, and yet there are these problems. And, yeah, shipping you know, production overseas to where you can get the cheapest labor is exactly the same process that we see in the 19th century.
David Cannadine, you write that Andrew Mellon was one of the biggest American lies of its time. Most people today are familiar with the names Cornelius Vanderbilt and Andrew Carnegie, but Andrew Mellon perhaps a bit less. Why do you think that is?
I think it's partly because he was, in his own person, extremely shy and retiring and self-effacing, though if you're Secretary of the United States Treasury for more than a decade, you can't be all that shy or retiring or self-effacing, I suppose. But it's partly, and indeed perhaps primarily, that most of the Mellon companies, such as Coppers, Gulf Oil, Alcoa, Carborundum, were not known by many people to be Mellon companies. And it's also that whereas Carnegie was closely identified with steel, Rockefeller with oil, Vanderbilt with railroads, J.P. Morgan with banking, Mellon's fortune was distributed across a whole range of different industries, so that it was in some senses more invisible, I think, than the other names with which we are more familiar, which were tied to one particular industry. I ought to say that Mellon certainly shared the view that both T.J. Stiles and David Nassau have mentioned about their respective subjects, that he thought that he was a hugely patriotic figure, that creating great companies built up the economic strength of America, created lots of jobs, made people better off, that this was altogether a good thing. What I think is also interesting about Mellon, and I don't think he's unique in this, is that he was perfectly in favor of competition in some industries and some contexts, but actually he was quite in favor of monopoly in others. He was perfectly happy that he owned almost all of the Pittsburgh coal mines. He was perfectly happy that Alcoa was a monopoly. And it is this curious world that we reach by the early 20th century of enormous competition in American industry in some ways, but of enormous monopolies in others. Hence, of course, the world of trust busting. And this notion that big business can be either competitive or in some senses monopolistic is, I think, one of the most interesting aspects, particularly of this phase of industrial development in America that we're talking about.
People took some interest in Mellon, what Mellon did when he was the Secretary of the Treasury under President Hoover at the beginning of the Depression, because he had very strong ideas, and they were contrasted with what we have done more recently in response to this economic crisis.
Yes, Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury during the period of from the Wall Street crash through to the Great Depression, and Mellon's view as a banker and somebody who had experienced business really from the 1870s on was that boom and bust were innate to the capitalist system, that the sign of a good business person or banker or industrialist was not just that they did well in good times, but they could survive and indeed advance in bad times. And the purpose, as Mellon saw it, of slumps was to purge out of the system what he called the rottenness, that's to say incompetent entrepreneurs, inefficient bankers, irresponsible bankers who've lent too much money. And Mellon believed that the federal government should not support banks, because if it did, bankers would behave foolishly, knowing that their company, their bank, was guaranteed by the government.
But wasn't he hurt by the Great Depression?
Well, that's a separate issue. I'm just talking about, in answer to your question, Mellon's views of the Great Depression, which were that depressions were an integral part of the capitalist system, and that a sign of a good business person was that they could survive. Mellon, of course, was hurt by the Great Depression in that he was less rich by the end of it than he was at the beginning, but that was true of everybody.
President Hoover said that Mellon belonged to the leave-it-alone liquidationist school. His formula to fix the economy was to liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate the farmers, liquidate real estate.
That's a good summary of what Mellon thought, yes.
It's kind of shocking today.
Carnegie also loved depressions and recessions. He understood, as all these guys did, that bust and boom is built into a capitalist economy. And
so these are moral hazards.
Well, yeah. They for Carnegie, when times were good, that was the time to save money. When times were bad, that was the time to use the money you had saved to buy up failing companies.
Yep.
You had to ride the waves. You had to understand the ups and downs of the economy, or you'd get thrown under.
That was exactly
Melanie. You know, Vanderbilt very much the same way. You know, taking advantage of weak times to buy up strategically valuable transportation lines that were underpriced and struggling. You know, very much the same pattern.
We have Mellon to take a little.
When Mellon was Secretary of the Treasury, he famously refused to give federal support to the Bank of Pittsburgh. The Bank of Pittsburgh was the Mellon's great rival in Pittsburgh, and it went to the wall.
We have to take a little break, and we will come back with our guest, T.J. Stiles, who's the first tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, won the National Book Award this year. We have David Nassau, who's Andrew Carnegie, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for biography, won the New York Historical Society's Prize in American History, and Sir David Cannadine, whose book on Andrew Mellon, Mellon and American Life, was named Best Book of the Year by The Economist magazine, The Washington Post, and The New York Times Book Review. We are talking about the robber barons and thinking about how their legacy affects the way things are today. To start off our show, The Leonard Lopate Show. Stay with us for more. I'm talking with three award-winning biographers, T.J. Stiles, whose book, The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, is published by Knopf, David Nassau, whose Andrew Carnegie, is published by Penguin, and Sir David Cannadine, whose Mellon and American Life is now available from Vintage Books. T.J., Vanderbilt created, as you've said, one of the largest business enterprises in history when he combined two railroad lines to create the New York Central and the Hudson River Railroad Company. Did he have the foresight to understand how important the railroads would be to the country's future, or was some of his success due simply to being in the right place at the right time?
Well, certainly the accident of having been born in New York was central to his career. I mean, even when Philadelphia was still a larger city than New York in the very early years of the Republic, it was clear to visitors from overseas that New York, because of its strategic location, would be the commercial center of the United States. And very early on in his life, he took advantage of the opportunities that arose because of New York's importance as a financial and transportation center. But on the other hand, he was very shrewd, and his life is very illuminating because he would follow in his transportation enterprises the main currents of trade in the American economy. You know, when for example, when Boston became the capital of the new industrial textile mills in New England, when the American first industrial revolution took off, Vanderbilt switched all of his lines from running between New York and Boston. And that brought him into contact with the early railroads. You know, railroads were such a capital-intensive enterprise that the first railroads are very short, and they connected with steamboats, and that's how he got involved in them. He often sold his steamboats to railroads in return for stock. And so that development was very important in the long term because it gave him an education in corporate management and in the ins and outs of the stock market, and it also taught him about railroads and the railroad business. So even though later he got involved in transatlantic steamship lines that ran to California during the gold rush, he grasped very early on the advantages that railroads had as a transportation technology.
Is this in some ways similar to what Bill Gates did when he capitalized on the rise of the computer age in a way that maybe IBM had missed?
I think that's a good way of putting it, because if you're thinking about geography, Vanderbilt not only, a lot of people were involved in building railroads. There are a lot of, you know, early corporations involved in starting them up. And yet he was very shrewd in terms of understanding which lines had the advantages, which lines had long-term potential, and understanding the advantages and costs, the way in which they served the changing areas of population, of industrial growth. He always sought out lines that had permanent advantages in terms of the amount of traffic that they attracted and the you know, their advantages in terms of cost. For example, more level lines, lines that had low grades and easy curves, things that that led to saved pennies and led to millions in profits.
Now, David Nassau, Carnegie also got into railroads. Did he get into it because he was inspired by Vanderbilt, or was it because he was already producing the steel that could be used in building railroads?
I think in large part he got into it because his mother was smart enough to bring him and the rest of the family to Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh was the hub, was the entrance to the West. So if you lived in Pittsburgh, you were well aware of the railroads. You could see them taking off for the Great West. He also understood immediately that the key to building the railroads were the iron ties, and that they were becoming too brittle. They had to be transferred. They had to be replaced with steel. He also understood, and the guy was amazing. He was into steel before any other American manufacturers. And he understood that the country was moving west, that the only way it would go west was on the railroad, and that the railroad was going to devour huge, huge amounts of steel.
Now, David Cannadine, Mellon was also instrumental in the development of Pittsburgh. Obviously, we've just heard from David Nassau, it's a matter of location, location, location. But now Pittsburgh is one of the more depressed cities in the United States, although I think it's making a bit of a comeback. Why was it so great then and not so great anymore?
Well, as David Nassau has rightly said, Pittsburgh was this extraordinary place, especially in the closing decades of the 19th century and the first decades of the 20th century. It was the most remarkable industrial metropolis, arguably anywhere in the world, and certainly in the United States, partly built on the basis of the extraordinary coal reserves that were close by, partly built on the basis of the steel, which in large part was, of course, Carnegie's doing. But in addition to that, a whole host of other industries gradually developed there, many of them, as it happens, financed by Andrew Mellon. Mellon, on the whole, didn't have much to do in business terms with Carnegie, though he was a very good friend of Frick's, who, of course, up to a point, and for a time at least, was a friend of Carnegie's. But Pittsburgh was this utterly extraordinary metropolis, industrial metropolis. It was known as hell with the lid taken off because, of course, one of the consequences of the mines and the steel mills was extraordinary environmental degradation. And it was a degraded environment, polluted, dark, smoky, sooty, right the way through until the 1950s. When I was working on Mellon, I talked to some people who remembered their parents saying that even in the early 1950s, if you went to downtown Pittsburgh for a day and you were a male worker, you had to take a second shirt because by lunchtime the collars and the cuffs were all covered in soot. So in one sense, Pittsburgh was the most extraordinarily successful place, and part cause, part consequence of that was this amazing grouping of entrepreneurs, Carnegie, Mellon, Frick, Westinghouse, Heinz, all of whom were there at this time. But on the other side, the environmental degradation was extraordinary, and the conditions of work and of life for most of the workers, who most of these people incidentally despised, were simply appalling.
I'm talking
so arguably, Pittsburgh is a much better place now, though it's economically less successful.
I'm talking to three award-winning biographers of robber barons, David Cannadine, Mellon, and American Life, David Nassau, Andrew Carnegie, T.J. Stiles, The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, the Mellon family commissioned Burton J. Hendrick to write a biography of Andrew Mellon after he died. Hendrick had previously written about Carnegie, but didn't seem that enthusiastic about Mellon. He wrote, Mellon lacks the personal qualities that made Carnegie so attractive a subject, nor, in other ways, was he so great a man, but his life was a historic one.
Well, One can always compare different biographical subjects and have varying views of them. I think it certainly is the case that Mellon was not a figure of warmth or charm. Nobody, I think, ever accused him of that, least of all his wife. On the other hand, there isn't any doubt that it was a very big and very extraordinary life. I think that Henrik, who wrote this first biography of Mellon, which wasn't published, he actually accumulated an amazing archive of interviews which he transcribed with people who'd known Mellon. But I think a lot of the material he probably felt constrained from using. I think he, on the basis of the material he had, which I've actually seen, he could have written a much more interesting book than in fact he did.
Now, TJ, we've been talking about Mellon as somebody who got involved with politics. Did Vanderbilt get involved in politics? Teddy Roosevelt was a key figure in American politics at this time, and he was a guy who fought the trusts.
Well, this is an interesting point I'm glad you brought up, which is the great distinction with Mellon having actually served in office and having been a policymaker himself, by contrast with Carnegie and Vanderbilt. Vanderbilt bridged an era from when families of great notable families provided the political leaders in America to an age when professional politicians began to dominate the political scene.
And we saw that transition with the Rockefeller family.
That what happened during Vanderbilt's life is that the wealthy began to, for the most part, retreat from actually holding office themselves, tending to, there are many exceptions, but tending to influence lawmakers rather than occupying office themselves. And in Vanderbilt's case, he was resolutely nonpartisan. So, for example, he was good friends with Ulysses S. Grant when he was president. They were both extremely fond of horses and were good buddies, is the way to put it. At the same time, he was very close friends with Horace Greeley when Greeley ran against Grant for president and actually had one of his railroad lawyers campaign for Greeley as a personal favor. His circle of advisors, including his son-in-law, Horace F. Clark, and one of his main advisors, Augustus Schell, were very influential players in the Democratic Party around the time of the Civil War and during Reconstruction. And they actually helped throw Boss Tweed out of Tammany Hall and were a part of the reform efforts that got Tweed and his cronies convicted.
Hadn't Vanderbilt wanted to have a canal go through Nicaragua, T.R., instead, was the force behind the Panama Canal.
That's right. Vanderbilt actually predated Theodore Roosevelt, but he got immensely entangled with not only federal policy but international diplomacy when he tried to build a canal across Nicaragua. It led to intense negotiations with the British, who claimed a protectorate over the Mosquito Coast of Nicaragua. And it led to a now-forgotten treaty that at the time was a major deal to allow for a canal to be built across Nicaragua. And it eventually led Vanderbilt to be involved in a war against an American adventurer, William Walker, who had taken over Nicaragua on his own account and had thousands of American recruits coming down to help him, and who had turned against Vanderbilt's transportation business there. And Vanderbilt actually had to engage in sort of a private foreign policy, sending down secret agents and crates of gold to lead commando raids from Costa Rica. The entire thing taught him a great deal about the importance of law and of government to large enterprises, to business. But at the same time, it taught him about the perils, these and other episodes, taught him about the perils of getting too closely involved. You know, the parties could change in the White House and in Congress, and he was never too tightly tied to anyone, not too tightly identified with anyone, so that he was not unduly disturbed, let's put it that way.
But Carnegie had an interesting relationship with Teddy Roosevelt, both positive and negatives. At one point, Teddy wrote of Carnegie that all the suffering from Spanish War comes far short of the suffering preventable and non-preventable among the operators of the Carnegie Steelworks and among the small investors during the time that Carnegie was making his fortune.
Well, Roosevelt at this time was furious with Carnegie because Carnegie was pushing towards second part of Carnegie's life, he was devoted himself to the cause of world peace, and he wanted Roosevelt to be a player. As a matter of fact, he bought Roosevelt. When Roosevelt retired, he wanted to go on an African safari, shoot a lot of animals, but he didn't have the money to do it. So Carnegie gave him tons of money, in return for which Roosevelt was supposed to go to Europe after his trip, bring together the Prussians and the English, and sign a bilateral treaty outlawing war. He was going to be Carnegie's agent. He didn't quite like to do that. The two of them fought. They negotiated. They bickered. They hugged each other in public and spoke ill of each other in private.
And in the case of Andrew Mellon, he had problems with another Roosevelt, although a complicated relationship as well. Didn't FDR actually go after him for tax evasion after he left the Treasury Department?
Well, Mellon had a very simple view of politics, which was that since the purpose of that business made the nation stronger and richer, and it made people wealthier, and it employed lots of people, so the purpose of politics was to create an environment in which business could flourish. And for Mellon, that was all there was to it, and that the serious enterprise of life was business, and the politics was a kind of second order of magnitude activity. So he was, of course, an ardent Republican all his life, and served in the administrations of Harding and then Coolidge and then Hoover. Then, of course, the world changes with FDR, the New Deal, all of the presumptions of Mellon's life, I think, about business, about trade unions, about a limited state, all of those presumptions were completely overturned in the era of the New Deal. And Mellon, who had been a kind of iconic figure in the 1920s, becomes a kind of villain in the 1930s. He's a banker. Bankers, of course, trouble. He's been Secretary of the Treasury. The slump occurs on his watch. He becomes a kind of bogeyman. As it were, in addition to that, he is prosecuted for tax evasion while FDR is president. The interesting thing about Mellon is that he broke a lot of laws when he was Secretary of the Treasury, in particular those which said that the Secretary of the Treasury shouldn't be involved in business. He remained involved in the business of all his companies. But actually, he was very careful to pay his taxes. So, ironically, they went after him for the wrong thing. But it's slightly like the fact that Al Capone was prosecuted for tax evasion. Tax evasion was a way of getting even with people, even if you couldn't get even with them the way you wanted to, you could still get even with them some other way. And the tax trial essentially discredited Mellon, his reputation in a way has never recovered.
Although he developed a certain amount of respect when he gave an incredible art collection to the National Gallery, the basis of the National Gallery's collection. It's interesting that he and his friend Frick wound up putting together such great art collections. I'm not sure that they had much taste or just simply knew that you buy a Vermeer, you buy a Goya, a Raphael, and you've done good. But all of them did give away a lot of their money, and this is a big issue right now. What do the super rich do with their money today?
Carnegie gave it all away, and Carnegie provided for his wife and his daughter. Then he gave it all away. The greatest tragedy in his life, aside from the Great War breaking out, was that he died with a large estate. Fortunately for him, he was distraught at the idea that he was going to die with money in the bank. But his good friend, Elihu Root, said, let's set up the Carnegie Corporation. Whatever's left over, you give to them, and, you know, it will be given away in good time.
And the Carnegie Foundation has been very generous over the years.
The Carnegie Foundation Corporation has done extraordinarily well because Andrew Carnegie was destroyed by compound interest. The more money he gave away, the more he made, and he didn't live long enough. He needed another 20 years to give it all away.
Now, what about Cornelius Vanderbilt, T.J. Stiles? Did he want to give away his money?
I just wanted to add one of the great points that David Nassau makes in his biography is that Carnegie used the justification that he wanted more money to give away more money. And that was a justification that allowed him to squeeze his workers and to carry out other practices that we find unsavory.
These are mixed legacies, economic growth, but still bad conditions for their workers and environmental destruction.
Exactly. And in Vanderbilt's case, he was motivated in his philanthropy, which was as a percentage of his wealth, far, far smaller than Carnegie giving away his entire estate. He was motivated by deep patriotism, and he was for an uneducated man, he had completely absorbed the concept of the invisible hand, and he strongly, deeply believed that the public interest was, in essence, everyone pursuing their own private interests as vigorously as possible. So his one sentiment, his one deep emotional sentiment was patriotism. And during the Civil War, he attempted to give away his largest steamship to the Union Navy, which he had built for close to $1 million, which was an enormous sum at the time. The Union Navy at first turned him down, and then when the Confederate ironclad Merrimack went on a rampage, they suddenly accepted. And without pay, he turned it into a warship. Then he carried out other services for the Union side. After the war, he saw himself as having a responsibility to help unify the country, and his philanthropy was directed along the lines of helping the South. Now, by the South, he thought of the white South. He was not particularly interested in helping the freed people, the emancipated slaves, but he carried out a number of steps, some of them rather remarkable. He was a bondsman for Jefferson Davis. He helped Jefferson Davis get out of federal prison. He helped endow a church for Southerners in New York City. And, of course, he matched his gift to the Union Navy of close to $1 million with a matching gift to endow Vanderbilt University. And it's interesting that was only 1% of his estimated estate at the time he died of $100 million. He gave $1 million to Vanderbilt University. And at the same time, it was probably the largest act of charity in American history up to that time. He was very focused on founding a dynasty and deliberately kept his wealth together. He did not want to fritter it away. But where he did give, he focused on this issue of unifying the country after the war.
We have very little time. David Cannadine, Mellon.
Mellon, somewhere between, in a sense, Carnegie and Vanderbilt, gave away roughly half his fortune. The other half went to his children. And it's from their fortunes, as they descend, that the Andrew Mellon Foundation is created, which is the one thing most people now associate with Mellon. The other half went to the creation of the National Gallery in Washington. And here again, as I've mentioned earlier, Mellon saw himself as an enabler. He provides his own art collection. He provides money for the building. He provides money for an endowment. And he then says that will launch it, and then other people must give their collections as well. And it will then grow into a great gallery. And that was why, although he could have called it the Mellon Gallery, he insisted on it being called the National Gallery, because he thought under those circumstances other collectors would give as well. So Mellon's philanthropy was hugely kind of ingenious in exactly the same way that his business life had been.
And we thank the three of you so much for being with us today. Sir David Cannadine, author of Mellon and American Life, T.J. Stiles, The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, and David Nassau, Andrew Carnegie. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. ¶¶